Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 86 of the show. I'm Carlos Clazo, joined by Ben Badler. What's up, Ben?
Happy draft rankings release, Carlos. How's everything going? New top 400 on the site.
It's good. I'm going to sleep a little bit more the next few days than I have like the last week or so. Yeah, 400 is out. Second in-season update of the year. A lot of movement throughout the list. Maybe not a ton at the very top end of the list, but yeah, it feels good. I guess in terms of rankings, there's only one other expansion until we're at the BA 500, which is kind of like the big ranking we try to get to each spring. That's coming up quick. And yeah, I don't know if I feel any more confident about this draft class, but it's been a fun one to cover. It's nice to have that up. We've got our second mock draft on the site. I'm sure if you listen to this podcast, you've already read that came out Monday. Big week for draft in general.
Yeah, I think we feel more confident about the top of the draft, though, than we did coming into the year. We were like, who's going to be number one? Or is there even like a strong number one candidate this year? And now it seems like Cleveland's got some pretty good options to pick from at the top.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have Charlie Condon still in the number one spot. He moved into that number one spot in our first in-season update, but I mean, I don't think he's done anything to, I think I wrote specifically this, that he's really done nothing to lessen his grip on that number one spot at this point. I'm curious how you view the separation of Condon and Bazana. This is a conversation I've had with a lot of scouts over the last week too, as I'm just trying to clarify our list and make sure we have them lined up in the correct order. But I've been talking to a lot of scouts about this. I know they've been asking me how I view Condon, like compared to previous number ones, like just how much of a gap there is with him and whoever's number two, if there is such a gap. I'm curious how you view it.
I think to me, those are the top tier of players. I know I like the other college hitters we have after that, but those two, I think, are the most complete offensive players there. And I guess with Bazana, you throw in the positional value too, of him being able to play second base as opposed to some of these other guys that are, you know, like Kurtz or Caglione, who are first base only or first base / left-handed pitcher in his case. I don't know. I could see Cleveland going with either one of those guys at 1-1. Probably lean.
I mean, I wouldn't even put it to two. I think it's a wider group than that. They're probably still considering, but.
Yeah, no, I think they'll probably consider others, but I think those are the top two at this point. Maybe it depends if somebody, like if Braden Montgomery, say, wants to take like a huge underslot deal. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's something would that be something that would shock you at all? Or
I don't think really. I mean, their team, we've talked about this a lot, they're a team that has consistently gone for those underslot deals with their first overall pick to kind of move that. Like, I guess there is some narrative out there that Cleveland is like cheap and doesn't spend on the draft. I'm not saying that at all. They're actually one of the teams that has gone up to the 5% overage pretty consistently in recent years. So they will use all their bonus pool, I'd imagine. And picking one, they're going to have more overage money than anyone else, just given the total pool they have. But no, I mean, I think Braden Montgomery is, I don't know if he is like exactly in the tier. I think you can maybe pick apart a little bit of how he does it offensively, maybe more than Condon and Bazana at this point. But if you don't view it as a significant gap and on draft day, one guy's willing to take $2 million less than the other, I mean, that's a significant difference. So given how they operate, I think all of those would be kind of on the table. And I think you could also lump in either of the pitchers. I mean, I would be curious to know the decision-making process for Pittsburgh a year ago. Like, how much did it factor into their decision to take Paul Skeens that it's just extremely expensive to go out and acquire top-of-the-rotation type arms? Maybe he was just the best player on their board and it was as simple as that, but I think that there is a case to be made for taking a guy like Burns or even Hagen Smith 1-1 if you just think that you don't get access to this sort of pitching talent at this price point ever. And you feel good about your pitching development, which Cleveland should definitely feel good about. That can make sense too. So I think you can make a case. Really the only guy who doesn't, like, I think Kurtz has a pretty well-rounded offensive profile. We can talk about the defense, but the only two that I think would be surprising if Cleveland took would be Caglione for me, just because he doesn't seem to fit the type of hitter they like. But I imagine he has to be in that conversation. And then Weatherholt, just because the amount of time he's been out maybe complicates things. But again, like you talk about overall offensive players, I think the top group is really hard for me to separate in my mind. And I don't know that Condon is like in the Adley Rutschman tier of clear over number one player. I think it's more maybe like a Spencer Torkelson situation where he's the one by most people, but the gap between him and whoever's next isn't huge, if that makes sense. I think basically the rest of the college season, the playoffs will be pretty important and maybe crucial in determining who they're taking.
Yeah, I think Bazana seems like the most Guardians-ish type of player. But I think that Charlie Condon, I think Condon fits what they look for too. It's maybe, you know, there's a lot of size and physicality, and I know they get associated with like shorter, smaller players, but it's huge. Like, I mean, top of the scale, or if not, then it's close to top of the scale raw power, but it's a lot of contact too. He's not swinging and missing. Yeah, he's 6'6". There's long limbs, but he's able to keep his swing pretty tight and compact and under control, especially for such a long levered hitter. I've been really impressed with just the pure hitting ability that he's shown this year, because the power was obvious, but he's been able to cut down on swing and miss this year. Like I think he'll go, you know, like we talked about before, I think he'll be right away a top 30 overall prospect. And I mean, if he keeps us up and with graduations coming up too, just from prospects of the top, you know, guys who are already in our top 30 right now in our top 100, like that may end up being pretty conservative. It's pretty phenomenal what he's done this year.
Yeah, I was looking at some batted ball data that we have for the draft players, and I'll just give you guys Condon and Travis Bazana, since those are the top two on the board and the top two we're talking about right now. But if you just look at the 115 college hitters that we have data on who are ranked inside our top 400, so this isn't every player in the country, but it's every college hitter who we have data for who's ranked in our list currently. Condon is fourth in average exit velocity, first in 90th percentile exit velocity, second in peak exit velocity, 26th in contact percentage, and 51st in chase rate. That's pretty loud. Top five in all of the EV categories, second in peak to only Jack Caglione. And then if you look at Travis Bazana, he maybe doesn't excel in any individual category, but when you combine all five, it's a really well-rounded profile, which is probably what you'd expect. Bazana's 10th in average exit velocity, 15th in 90th percentile, 35th in peak, 16th in contact percentage, and 14th in chase rate. I mean, none of those are probably surprising to you guys based on just how we talk about these players and the fact that you all are probably pretty plugged into what they've been doing this year. But just the fact that the data kind of backs up a lot of what we're thinking about these players and maybe hammers it home more for a player like Cleveland, who probably is, those metrics are probably pretty important for them and their decisions.
Was there, when you were putting together this updated top, well, to top 400, but just looking at the guys who are in the top 10 or especially the top eight, was there any surprises for you or anything that really jumped out from the calls when you were talking to scouts trying to line up these guys?
Definitely not in the top eight. I would say it was more just increased confidence that the top eight we have are the correct eight on the board. All of the players in that top eight range are the same players that we had previously, with Connor Griffin in the nine spot, again, kind of the first player that people mentioned right after that grouping, and some teams even have him inside that tier one of players. I think the players who are at the back of that group now, Kurtz and Weatherholt, make some sense, just given the seasons they've had, some of the injury question marks, Brandon Montgomery moving up a bit, and then the top three is the same top three still. So not shocking there. I think after the top 10 is really when you get into a lot more movement on the board, just with some high school players performing, some high school pitchers especially, and then college hitters moving up like James Tibbs, Walker Yannick, Carson Benj, Dakota Jordan, as pretty significant up air names in the top 30 range. So nothing too crazy in top 10 now, but everyone that I've talked to seems to be kind of wondering what the board is going to look like once we get into the middle of the first round. If you read the mock draft, you probably picked up on this. I tried to just highlight how chaotic and wide open it is at this point. Teams who are not picking in the top 10 really don't have a great feel for like who their targets are now. And I think that's just part of the nature of it being kind of a weaker class outside of that top group.
Would you like to see teams be allowed to trade draft picks?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be beneficial. I think teams like the Dodgers would really kick a lot of teams' asses if that was allowed.
Why would they benefit from that?
I mean, I just think they do everything at a really high level. So I think they would have a good gauge on evaluating the picks in the first place. I think they do a good job scouting. The fact that they have done such a good job scouting at the back of the first round, like letting them or allowing them the creativity to kind of move even more around the boards than what the slotting system allows you, I think they would be good. Teams like that, teams like the Rays, teams like the Padres, teams like the Rangers, I'd be really excited to see kind of how they navigated a draft if they were allowed to trade. I think that would be a lot of fun. And honestly, I just feel like you'd get a lot different style. I mean, maybe there would be some owners who just try and trade away picks because they don't want to spend in the draft. But I also feel like that's pretty counterintuitive, because if you are an owner and you want to acquire talent on the cheap, the draft is, there's no better way. So paradoxically, you want to acquire more draft picks and more pool money, because if you can get your stars in the draft, it's certainly a premium.
Yeah, I'd like to see teams have more freedom to do what they want in the draft and do what they want with trades. I mean, especially with a draft push back now closer to the actual trade deadline, you could actually just, you know, you could have trades start even earlier in July.
I wonder if that would allow teams who are competing, like, you wouldn't necessarily have to have like a loaded farm system to make some win now moves at the deadline if you wanted to, because you've got this entirely new area of capital that you previously couldn't move that you can now via draft picks. If, let's say, like, maybe you're competitive, you don't think this is a great draft class, you can move away some of your picks to try and either swing a deal or be the finishing touches to a deal that you're already close to making. I think it would make everything more exciting, to be honest. It would maybe not the actual mock drafts themselves. I don't know how people feel about the NFL mock drafts, where people are, as far as I know, it feels like the writers kind of conjure up trades that they think make sense, but I don't
know. They just make fake trades in a mock draft?
Yeah, I mean, they can make trades in mocks, so it is common for, I don't know
what is the success rate of predicting.
I have no idea.
Like 0%.
I have no idea. The other day, Teddy and JJ were talking about whether or not. Actually, I think Josh brought this up, because I guess someone made like a full 7-round mock draft for the NFL, and I guess Josh was basically saying, would it be more or less difficult to do that for baseball if they went to a hard slotting system? And I basically was like, I feel like it would just be kind of a joke to do that, because the board is just so wide open, and thinking about like asking teams who they would take in the third round is just kind of a ludicrous like exercise to even go through. But yeah, I don't know the hit rates of NFL mock drafts. I would be curious. Intuitively, I would think they have better hit rates than baseball, just because so many teams, you can probably eliminate entire position groups in the first round, and you can't really do that in baseball. But yeah, I don't know. I'm far away from being an expert on NFL mocks and the NFL draft.
Well, you could institute a deadline for when you could trade a draft pick. If you wanted to trade draft picks and say the draft is July, 17th, whatever it is. All right, 24 or 48 hours before the draft, you can't. You can trade a pick up until then, but that's the deadline for trading a draft pick. That way we can protect Carlos's ability to conduct a mock draft.
As much as that maybe would be nice, I think that also eliminates the most fun part about pick trading, which is the draft day or on the clock trading. That's got to be a fun part, right? A player starts sliding further down the board than a team maybe expects. They're like, oh, we can trade up now to get him. That'd be the fun point. But
or just trade for you could just collect picks that you then use just for the bonus pool money too. If you're like, oh, this guy's still here, we can take him, but we need more bonus pool money. We need more pick values from this fourth yeah. round pick or this fifth round pick to be able to sign this guy later.
And see, I think that element too, I hadn't even really thought about that, but the baseball's draft is just so complicated already. Adding pick trades just makes it, I don't know what the factor is, but significantly more complicated just because of that. And it feels like whoever has the team in place on draft day who can do all of this accounting that you would need to do. And I don't know how, like, the difference in how certain teams would value the picks and pool money versus another team, I think would lead to a lot of really odd trades, maybe especially the first few years when teams are trying to get a gauge on it. I don't know. Maybe that's something that teams like intuitively have a better understanding on already, just because of the slot value that's like directly assigned to them. I'm not sure.
You would probably get more prospects, like prospect for draft pick trades, I would think, because you're not necessarily like you're not trading for need in the draft. Like you're trading up because you want a certain player, but you don't necessarily want to give up a piece from your major league roster, or it might not necessarily be a fit between the, say, just pick a team at random that has a good record this year. It's going to be contending the Guardians, who, I mean, how often does a team pick first overall and on the day of the draft have the best record in baseball, like the Guardians are going to have this year, potentially? Yeah. Like they have right now.
That's a good call.
But if you're trying to trade and upgrade your major league roster, like, but you need to find a match, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you would see more prospects get traded for draft picks than you would see necessarily players from a big league club that would line up in a trade with the right team with two teams that want to trade up and trade down simultaneously. Yeah.
That is interesting too. It would be like teams on draft day, maybe like getting some early returns they don't love from prospect and then trying to flip that into maybe another speculation on a new prospect that's a little shinier and doesn't have the maybe the negatives from just being in pro ball and performing, or maybe it's the opposite case where like there's a really shiny prospect in one org, but a team is just super high on like a guy like Charlie Condon. Like how much would you have to give up to move into that number one spot if you're a team that does view it as a significant amount of separation between Condon and whoever's second? Like imagining the Reds and the Guardians just flipping picks there. That'd be fascinating too.
Yeah. Or you could have a team trade up potentially, not even just for, oh, because we want this player who, let's say the 10th overall pick, because we really want this guy at 10. It's more, we actually want the 10th overall pick's slot value or pick value, and then we'll still underslot a guy at this pick just so we can have more bonus pool money to spend on somebody else later.
Yeah, and that is another element that's interesting, because you can acquire all the bonus pool money that you want, but it still doesn't guarantee that you're going to get the guy to float down on an overslot deal, because there's always a chance that someone picking in between where you moved from and where you have your next pick just says, yeah, like, so what if you have a deal? We're taking you. We're going to give you X amount of bonus pool money and you can turn it down if you want. We'll get another pick next year as compensation. So it still would be a pretty significant gamble. And I wonder if that risk alone would limit like how much pool money you could acquire. Like, yeah, maybe it would be easy to acquire $4 or $5 million of extra bonus pool money, but would you even be able to feel confident in getting the players who are worth handing out that bonus pool money to? I think that's always a question that would maybe hold back, like just how insane or how crazy the trading would get for baseball's draft.
The next step would be when they implement the international draft, and then you could trade your first round pick in the States in the draft in July, and you could trade for like multiple international picks and have it go that way.
Yeah. Ben, you really just want to make this as complex and convoluted as you possibly can, don't you? What else can we throw into the mix?
I'm all for freedom. So if teams want to, like, if you want to trade up, you should be able to trade up. If you really love international players and you'd rather have a team's first round pick in an international draft, you should be able to reallocate your resources there. And
teams should be able to trade players they've reached deals with under the table in the international market. That's the next step too.
Well, in this instance, you'd have a draft, so that wouldn't be a factor, but Yeah, no, I'd be all for more freedom to maneuver around in the draft.
I wouldn't get too excited about this coming to baseball. I don't think there's much progress there.
I mean, they made some pretty significant changes to the drafts in the last couple of years. I don't know if White Sox fans are too excited about that.
Yeah, when you mentioned the nugget about the Guardians picking one and maybe having the best record in baseball, I immediately just thought about the White Sox potentially having the worst record in baseball and also knowing they were not going to have a top nine pick.
Yeah.
It's bad for White Sox fans. But I think it's a good new addition. I like it. I know. I've seen a lot of people who kind of like it on social media. So I'm sure White Sox fans don't love it. But even some of the White Sox fans were like, honestly, this is what we get at this point. So they're really in it at this moment. But
what's Noah Schultz has looked phenomenal this year. We can give White Sox fans something to be happy about. He certainly is. I mean, he already had phenomenal stuff. I don't even know if it's better or he's just continuing to show it this year. But I mean, upper 90s fastball, wipeout slider. He's what, 6'9", 6'10", coming at you from a tough angle. He's throwing strikes. He struck out. I think it's almost a 50% strikeout this year in high A. He's just looked phenomenal.
Yeah, I was looking through some of the pitching data that we have our hands on. And just the difference in his overall stuff plus metrics year over year is a pretty significant jump. I don't know which exact pitches the model seems to like better, but he's been good. I feel like every time he's been on the field, he's been pretty electric. And yeah, like you said, just the angle and the size he comes at you with, he's a fun pitcher.
Yeah, the on the field part is obviously the key with him. He threw 27 innings last year. They were very, very cautious with his workload. So I hope he can stay healthy, because I think if he is able to shoulder a starter's workload, the upside is there for him to be a number one starter.
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at his ERA, it maybe isn't crazy. It's a 4.50 ERA in three starts in 12 innings, but the strikeout to walk is just nutty.
Oh yeah. He's
23 strikeouts, 5 walks. I was trying to pull up the South Atlantic League leaderboards and just see if anyone's even close to what he's doing. So I'll let you know when I get that. But yeah, he's been pretty good. Who else has been exciting for you to start the year that we haven't touched on the pod?
You know who's been really good? Just a couple guys from last year's draft. One, Chase Dolander with the Rockies has looked, I did not expect him to be this good right away. I mean, obviously he was a first round pick last year out of Tennessee, 9th overall, but he was better as a sophomore in 2022 than he was as a junior in 2023. Like, he was a top 10 overall pick who seemed to be trending the wrong way. I mean, obviously you still saw the stuff to be excited about, but just the results, the consistency, we're not there. There are some questions about the, not just the consistency of like execution of his stuff, but maybe the consistency of the stuff overall too. But this year he's gone out and he's looked really good. I mean, it's in high A, 2.93 ERA, 27-5 strikeout to walk in 15 1/3 innings. And the stuff has looked really, really good so far.
Yeah, I was very encouraged by his start. He was a guy who was fascinating for a number of reasons on draft day. I mean, being selected by a team like the Rockies, which is not exactly where you want to be if you're a pitcher, and just how inconsistent he was year over year at Tennessee. But like you said, 2.93 ERA, 3 starts, 15 innings, 27 punchouts, 5 walks. It seems like he is kind of, maybe too early to say, but a little bit closer to the 2022 version of Chase Dolander, who, again, I mean, I think even if he had sustained what he did in 2022, Paul Skenes would have surpassed him with how good Paul Skenes was. But Chase Dolander was entering that draft cycle as one of the best college pitching prospects we'd seen in years, better than guys like Jack Leiter, Kamar Rocker, Asa Lacy, Max Meyer, some of the other top of the class college pitchers. Like, scouts pretty close to unanimously viewed him as like a better talent than all of those guys entering the year. the way it looks on the mound, the delivery, the athleticism, the depth of the pitch mix, the command. I'm not sure how far you've like dug into it, Ben, or what you think about his command, but that maybe was more like the fastball shape and the slider shape backed up a little bit year over year. But I thought the biggest thing was just his command didn't look as crisp in 23 as it did in 22. And if he's kind of bounced back in that area, I feel like the whole arsenal is just going to look a lot better. And the walk rate is good, but I haven't really gotten into the weeds to see, like, is he spotting that fastball up in the zone? Is the slider more consistently located out of the heart of the zone? That was kind of a bugaboo for him early in the spring where he was letting up home runs. So I'm glad to see Dolander looking good because he's an arm that I really just love.
Yeah, I mean, he's sitting 95, 97 right now, touching 98, real high spin on the breaking stuff too. So yeah, all the reasons to be excited about Chase Dolander when you drafted him are there, and now the results are starting to match the talent that he at least was flashing at Tennessee. And now again, it's only three starts. Like, I don't want to say his stuff has gotten better necessarily, but certainly the results and the execution have been a lot better this year.
And he's sitting 95 with just a really flat approach angle with his fastball. I know in college that was always a number that people were excited about. So seeing that again this year looked pretty elite. It doesn't look like the greatest IVB numbers in the world, but the fact that he's able to attack from that angle he does just helps that pitch play up even more. So I guess if he's keeping that pitch up in the zone and avoiding the bottom of it, he'll be in good shape. I'm curious if he's given up. The home run rate looks fine, so that's good.
Yeah, he's looked good. Another top 100 guy who I think will move up again in our top 100 update, our next top 100 update from that 2023 draft, is Matt Shaw with the Cubs. I mean,
he keeps hitting, huh?
Dude, he just doesn't stop. Ever since, well, even before he's signed, obviously, but he's hit. But I mean, since signing, he's just raked at every level. He's hitting for power. He's in Double A now. It's 289, 448, 533 in Double A. Almost as many walks as strikeouts. It's, you know, control of the zone, good swing, impact is there. I don't know how much more you could ask for him. You know, playing third base regularly, I think it's probably a good fit for him. Defensively, everything looks like it's going to profile really well at third base, at least offensively.
Yeah, I think even at the time of the draft, there were a lot of scouts who didn't really view him as a long-term shortstop, maybe a guy who starts his career there. But I think pretty consistently we heard that second base or third base would be better fits for him. So if he's looking good at the hot corner and continue to do what he's doing offensively, just a really fun power, speed, and maybe even a better pure hit tool than I was kind of expecting so far. How long do you think that he's going to stick around in Double A? Because he finished his pro debut. He went from rookie ball to High A to Double A. He's starting back at Double A in 2024. 22 years old. We have seen a lot of these college players push pretty quickly. So he's looking at about 30 games at the level now and has been pretty excellent in both of his stints. So it's been nice to see.
Yeah. I think when we update the top 100, he'll be somebody who's going to have to move up a little bit more.
So right now we've got him at 29. What sort of range would you kind of view him in at this point?
That's a good question.
I mean, we should have guys like, actually, I don't know when the next time we update the 100 is. Are we doing that monthly this year?
We'll have an update soon. I mean, I think he's getting closer to 20 than 29 at this point.
Yeah, that seems fair.
But
I mean, there's not a clear area in his game that you wonder about at this stage. I guess if the reviews on his defense at third just aren't great, then that's maybe something to consider. But I imagine he'll be a solid average, reliable defender at either of those positions.
Yeah, no, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't be able to stay there.
Yeah. All right, he's been good. Who else you got? How about one of my guys from last year's draft? Blake Mitchell, the guy everyone loves to hate. Have you Have you changed your thoughts on Blake Mitchell at all, what he's doing? He continues to have a pretty odd line. A lot of walks, maybe a lot of strikeouts, some contact questions, but he's still catching, and he's put up – I don't know how you would classify what he's done so far in the minors. I'm pulling up his line right now. But, yeah, in the Carolina League, low A, he's hitting 275, 456, 471, two home runs, four doubles, splitting time at catcher and DHing as well. What are your thoughts on Blake Mitchell?
Yeah, I don't know if love to hate is a fair characterization.
I found myself coming to his defense a lot in our prospect meetings and post-draft. I think there's something about high school catchers, and maybe as part of like the high school catcher on an underslot deal inside the top 10 in that draft class, that some people just weren't enthused with.
I think it's just where he was picked, right? Eighth overall is when there were better options on the board, I think, right? Like Matt Shaw for one, or other. I mean, right behind him was Chase Dolander. Could have had him, Colt Emerson, a whole bunch of other high school hitters who went in the back of the first round.
Yeah, the Colt Emerson one, I guess. I mean, we had Blake Mitchell ranked ahead of Colt Emerson on draft day, so I just didn't think it was as crazy as maybe a lot of people thought. We had Blake Mitchell ranked squarely in the middle of the first round. He's got big tools, and he has shown a strong approach. I mean, it's a really well over 400 OBP in multiple years now in pro ball. I do wonder a little bit about the overall contact and the swing and miss in his game. He does miss a decent amount. I only imagine that'll be exposed more as he progresses. It's both overall miss, like well over 30%, and then end zone miss is also kind of concerning. So maybe he just winds up being more of that like kind of three true outcomes hitter if he keeps that raw power up that we saw in high school and is able to tap into that with Wood against pro pitching. I still think that could be a really valuable player, especially if he winds up being as good defensively as I thought he had a chance to be coming out of the draft.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see the run that he's gone on recently. Certainly the walks are a good sign to see there. The contact, yeah, I mean, that's one of the concerns that I have with him. It's still running a pretty high strikeout rate. It's, what,
31%? Yeah,
31% for, for a guy in low A. And then, you know, what the strikeouts last year were high after he signed too. So that's still a concern for me. The walks do offset it some. No doubts for me that he can stick behind the play. Like, I know he's not throwing out a lot of runners right now, but I don't think that's going to be an issue long term for him. So, yeah, I mean, again, like I think he's a good prospect. The contact consistency is something that is something I'll be keeping my eye on pretty closely with him, though.
Yeah. I would imagine the same people who like Emmanuel Rodriguez would be more towards the optimistic side with Blake Mitchell, and the same people who are maybe more critical and on the lower end for a guy like Erod would also be towards the lower end for Blake Mitchell, because it's not quite as extreme with Mitchell, and he's not hitting the ball as hard as Emmanuel Rodriguez does.
Right, yeah, now, I don't know that he has the power that Rodriguez has, though.
Yeah, but I think you also have the defensive profile that he offers maybe makes the overall package seem more, not, I wouldn't put them in the same prospect tier, but just in the sense of a guy who doesn't chase, a guy who has some swing and miss questions, and a guy who can hit for power, kind of in broad strokes. They remind me of each other.
All right. Are you putting Blake Mitchell in the top 100?
I think I would have been fine with Blake Mitchell on the back of the 500, like in the 80 to 100 range, probably last year. I think I've been the most bullish on the staff on him. I think he fits now. If you don't want to put him on because of the contact questions, I get it. He just has to make a little bit more contact than what he is making. But I think, again, like unless we get feedback coming back that the catching has just really not been good, I would be pretty fine putting him there.
Yeah.
How about you?
No, he'd be outside. There are other guys from the 2020. Even there are other guys. There's a bunch of other guys I would have ahead of him, including several players just from the 2023 draft alone who I would add on before Mitchell.
He would not be first for me, but there are a lot of players I like who are not on the list who I could see coming on with no problem as we get more graduations. So yeah, I'm probably in agreement with you, but I definitely feel more bullish on him probably than anyone on our staff. So we'll see how that works out for me.
I take it you're excited about Twins outfielder Emmanuel Rodriguez's start, though.
Yeah, he's been good, huh?
Yeah, it's still the same kind of exciting strengths and weaknesses to the skill set. Obviously, like the overall slash line being 306, 507, 714 is pretty exciting for a 21-year-old. And is he 21 yet? Yeah, 21-year-old and double A just turned 21.
In February.
Yeah, it's still a lot of the same three true outcomes type profile, though, with him, I think.
Yeah, the guy just gets on base, so I really don't know what's not to like about it. As long as he keeps getting on base, I don't particularly mind how he does it. I guess maybe you could say that more advanced pitching will take advantage of that a little bit more, but it's looked pretty good in double A. It's only 15 games, hit 4 home runs, 6 doubles, hits the ball hard. He's just never expanding the zone. I would imagine he's got one of the better batting eyes. I don't know like if it crosses into like him just being too passive at the plate. But analytics guys probably love it. They don't want people to swing the bat at all. And what's his swing rate right now? Yeah, he's swinging less than a third of the time, which is like extremely low. That's like, I think Juan Soto had the lowest a year ago among qualified hitters. So it's like Soto-esque in terms of how often he's actually swinging the bat. Certainly doesn't have the sort of contact ability. But yeah, I mean, I like this profile. The power, impatience, approach. What do you think of him defensively?
I don't know. I think he's, I don't think he looks like your classic center fielder. But I haven't talked to scouts about him yet this year defensively to say like how he's looked this year. So I wouldn't want to speak to that. But just based on previous years, I would think probably more corner outfielder, but I wouldn't run him off center field just yet.
Yeah. So this is a guy who I think 2 years ago, maybe I had stuffed, then I backed off that a little bit in our last top 100. He's at 51 right now on the top 100. Would you have him higher than that given this start? Or is this approach, like, is this sort of approach with the question marks that he has, is it a matter of like, if he keeps being productive with it as he moves up levels, you have more comfort with it? Or is it going to be an approach and like a skill set that you have questions about no matter what?
I mean, I just don't think I wouldn't move him up because I don't know that he's showing something different this year other than just adding some double A performance now to his track record. But like, I don't know that any of the underlying skills there in terms of his true talent level have really changed much to alter what the projections for him should be. I mean, like, yeah, like his batting average is higher, but I think we probably both expect that to come down pretty significantly just given the strikeout rate. But yeah, he's going to walk a lot. He's going to offset a lot of the empty strikeouts with walks to amplify his on base percentage. And, you know, he has huge raw power, whether, you know, it's going to be fine, whether it's in center field or a corner outfielder, it's going to come with a lot of swing and miss too. So I wouldn't move him up because I don't see anything that's really changed about his profile. Would he be a guy you think would move up, or would he, maybe you might be just higher on him coming into the year than maybe where we had him?
That could be true. I'm trying to see if anything with his batted ball profile has changed. If he's a guy who's like suddenly getting the ball in the air more, that maybe would have me a little bit more encouraged. It looks like the fly ball rate is up a tick. It's not something I would like maybe lean into super strongly at this stage quite yet, but I mean, I would like a guy like him to be hitting the ball in the air more frequently because I do think he has a lot of power. So I would inch him up just because, again, I think with this profile, one of the questions that I would have just in general of any player who's very passive at the plate and walks a lot and strikes out a lot is like, are more advanced pitchers just going to be able to attack you within the zone and kind of negate some of the walks? And so far that hasn't been the case. So I think I would be more encouraged in this player being able to be a valuable hitter and offensive player as he does at the higher level. So yeah, I would inch him upwards, but I think that you make a good point about like nothing in the profile has really changed in a significant way. I will be curious if there's like a swing change that he's made that is helping him get the ball in the air more often, or if it's just like some noise from early season results that has like a 10% jump in fly ball rate. Because I do think that piece is interesting.
So on the other hand, there are quite a few players in our top 100 right now who are struggling. Most of them, or not, I don't know most, but a lot of them, it's like it's early. Guys are just slow starts. Some of these guys are playing in the Midwest League in April, cold temperatures, all that. No big deal, no major red flag cause for concern right now. But
yeah,
some of them I do have more concerns about. I'll bounce some names off you. One of them is Roderick Arias, Yankee shortstop. We have him ranked number 65 on our top 100 right now. And, big international signing out of the Dominican Republic for them a couple of years ago. And last year in the Florida Complex League, he looked great. And this year he is in low A, 19 years old. He has struck out 28 times in 15 games. He's running a 41% K rate right now. It's early, but at a certain point, it's hard to crawl back from that hole. I mean, even if he goes, it's 69 plate appearances. So if he doesn't strike out in his next 31 trips to the plate, it's still at 28%.
Yeah. And again, K rate is one of the quickest stats we can look at with confidence, just how quickly it stabilizes. And he's also just missing almost half the time. I'd say we're very deep into the scary territory there with his contact skills.
Yeah. So I'm not giving up on Roderick Arias by any means, but I think he's somebody who, I think we've got to move him down in our next update. And he was a guy who struggled with strikeouts his first year in the DSL, and then last year really cut down on his swing and miss when he was in the Florida Complex League, and he had a great year there and was getting really strong reviews from scouts who saw him there. And there's still a lot of other things to like with him. But, guys who swing and miss that much in low A is a pretty major red flag for me. I'm pretty worried.
Yeah, I think it is very concerning. I mean, it's similar to a guy like Elijah Green. He's a guy who had massive tools, massive athleticism and power. We started him
out. Still does.
Yep, he still does. We started him out in the 100, dropped him out because of the contact questions. And if you look at Roderick Arias's miss rates, his zone miss rates, his chase rates, they're all in line with what Elijah Green is doing. So, I don't think Arias has the sort of pure tools that Elijah Green did. And if he's got the same miss questions, I would be right in line with you as being pretty concerned about that. I probably would not view him as a top 100 guy at this stage, but I don't know if I had a really strong opinion on him one way or another coming in. So it's not like talking me off a guy that I really like, which was the case with Elijah Green.
Yeah, he's, he does have other tools. I mean, there's power. He has close to a top of the scale arm. It's at least a plus plus arm, maybe conservative. He can run pretty well. There's maybe not Elijah Green type tools, but it's pretty loud tools. But the bat is the most important one. And right now, definitely seeing some concerns there.
Yeah, I guess for me, it's like when we have players who have real question marks in one area of whether it's contact or power or approach, I'm okay if the other two are really solid. This is basically why I'm like more in on guys like Blake Mitchell and Emmanuel Rodriguez. But when it's all three that are big questions, and again, I don't know how much you view the power as being a question, but for me, it's like it's not the same sort of raw power that you're getting with Elijah Green. So yeah, there's not a lot to get me excited at this point.
So here's another guy who's swinging and missing a good amount right now. Sebastian Wolcott with the Rangers, so he's hitting through 14 games. He's hitting 157, 246, 235, 20 strikeouts in 57 plate appearances. So that's a 35% K rate. However, he is 18 years old, so he's younger than Roderick Arias, right? He signed the following international signing class. There is what the Texas big international signing out of the Bahamas that year. And the Rangers have sent him to High A for some reason that I think we talked about before, that I didn't quite understand why they were being so aggressive with him. Cause he, you know, he's another guy who has tremendous athleticism and raw tools, but there's definitely rawness to his game. He was in, you know, he played above the complex league for like a handful of games last year, and that was it. And now he's in High A already. I don't quite understand it, unless maybe they're trying to.
I know that part of it seemed to be like just the fact that he spoke more English than Spanish was given as a reason why he skipped some of those levels, maybe just to put him around players that he can actually talk to more consistently. But
why not low A instead of High A this year? He's 18 years old, right? He's the same age as a high school senior, right? I mean, I don't want to like keep picking on the same old for the class draft guys, but he's younger than some of the, you know, high school seniors who are in the 2024 draft right now. So I don't know how, I guess I don't quite know what to make, because you still see some good swings from him, but I would have him lower on the top 100. I would probably just be lower on him coming into the year too. So I see things that are concerning, but there's also a lot of complicating factors just in terms of the context and trying to evaluate him right now. And I think he's pretty clearly playing at a level that's above his readiness at the moment.
Yeah, I'm curious how much teams think they need to give players leash before they make an adjustment in terms of level. Like, is it like, okay, we're giving him X amount of days, then we'll evaluate? Or is it just a case where the performance should maybe dictate that a little bit more than I made it out in that first point? Like, I don't know how many games is too many when a player is not succeeding and you need to reevaluate what level they're at.
In turn, like, would you demote him, you mean, or?
Yeah, if he's not succeeding at High A, do you think he needs to go to Low A to kind of get his head on straight, get some confidence? Or do you think he's just at High A? We're just going to have him hit .160 the whole year at High A.
I don't know. You don't see too many prospect demotions unless it's maybe sending a guy back to the complex.
Jordan Walker says hello.
But that's...
Jackson Holiday about to get sent down.
Sure, from the varsity league where the wins and losses matter, obviously. But you don't typically see a guy go from High A back down to Low A or Double A back down to High A.
Do you think there's a level of performance where it maybe is beneficial for the player, even if it's literally entirely just to get his mental to his head straight? Like, go have some success, rebuild your confidence, then come give another shot.
I don't know. So I know some teams.
Sounds like you're out on that. I don't think it's too crazy. If you were too aggressive with a player's assignment, I don't think it's like, I would rather you put him where he belongs. Like, we're talking about how it is a really aggressive assignment. Why don't you put him in Low A?
You think it would be better for him mentally to get demoted?
I think that it could be very hard for a young player to fail over and over and over again. And yeah, I think it could potentially be better. I mean, I don't know. Sebastian, maybe he's a guy that, like, the demotion would be more of a failure than not performing at High A. I can't imagine the leagues are too different where that's the case, but I mean, maybe it is, just knowing that you're going backwards, but at the same time, like, having some success seems helpful.
I know there are, like, have been times where a player has maybe not struggling to this extent, but struggling, not putting up the numbers that he had in previous years, and the team's actually promoted the player because they're thinking, all right, we want to like just reset his stats so he can have more confidence that way, because he's dug himself into such a deep hole statistically already that even if he starts to turn things around, it's not going to look great. So they promoted him that way. I don't think he's going to.
Fortunately, on B-Rec, I don't
think the Rangers are going to do that.
We can put all the numbers together and still find out what you've been doing over the course of the whole year. That seems odd. One other thing I thought about too is how some people think that teams will be really aggressive with their promotions, so players will look better for their age relative to a level. this is like the anti that. Like, he's not going to look as good on your models because you just demoted him to a lower level and his age isn't quite as an outlier. But if that's the level he needs to be at, like skill wise and development wise, I think it should be something that's considered.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not like out on Sebastian Wolcott or anything like that, but because clearly a lot of size, tools, raw power, athleticism, he can run, yeah, strong arm, power, but I mean, the hit tool is a question coming into the year, and it's
yeah,
still,
he had still a 30% strikeout rate previously, and we had the note too that he's consistently struggled against sliders and breaking stuff. So yeah, maybe that's just a pitch that he's trying to figure out. I mean, it hasn't been great so far.
Yeah.
All right, who else you want to bang on here, Ben? Who else you shoving out of the 100?
You know what? Harry Ford with Seattle.
Not Harry Ford.
Yeah. I mean, I liked Harry Ford a lot coming out of the draft. Really good athlete and very patient approach. He's definitely shown that throughout his minor league career. 103 walks last year. He seems to have a really good idea for the strike zone, but I do think he'll turn things around offensively. I mean, he's hitting 183, 310, 317 right now in Double A. But I don't know that he's going to stick behind the plate. I think that to me is a big concern. I think he's had a lot of trouble blocking balls. It's a lot of running, a lot more running to the backstop than there should be, than you'd like to have in a catcher. And then if he moves off the position, he certainly has the athleticism to play another position. I don't know if the offensive upside is there or will ever materialize for him to be an everyday player if he does have to go to another position.
Yeah, I don't know how difficult it would be for a guy like him to go out there and play center again. Like he played center sparingly in high school at some events, and he looked good at the time. But it could be the case that the run tool has backed up since then, playing so much catcher. I also just don't know how much it's difficult to catch up on the reps out there in the outfield. So I would be intrigued where he does play if he moves off the position, and he is a really strong athlete. Yeah, I'm maybe not quite as bearish on his catching ability as you are. I think like he can do enough to stick back there. But also like if you're not hitting, it's not like he's forcing his bat to stay at the position. Like you can put up with a fringy or below average defender if you're getting a lot with the bat or getting a lot with the arm, but none of those other tools seem quite as loud as they would need to be to put up with an iffy catcher at the big league level. So yeah, it is a real question mark for him at this point. He's not going to chase. It feels like at this point he's always going to walk at a high clip, but yeah, it's not been a great start in his first look at Double A in 15 games.
Yeah, I mean, we have him at 59 right now on our top 100. To me, I don't know if I would have him. I was lower on him coming into the year, obviously, but right now,
I mean, I feel like we'd both rather have a guy like Ralphie Velasquez, who's not even catching right now, than a guy like Kerry Ford.
All right. I see. I was like, why Ralphie? But
just think of catchers moving off the position. Yeah. If you think Harry's going to move off the position, and Ralphie being a guy who we probably have a lot more confidence in the offensive package at this stage. And then like, even if, let's say you took my stance on like, he can be a passable, let's say 45 defender at catcher. Would you rather have him or a guy like Kerry Ford or a guy like Ralphie Velasquez, excuse me, knowing he's going to be a first baseman? I think you might even still take the first baseman.
I mean, if I had more confidence that Harry Ford could catch, there are still things I like about his offensive game. I just think the defense is the bigger question with him.
What do you think about the hit tool and the power with Harry Ford? Like, what else? I feel like for me, the one positive you can really feel confident about is just the fact that his swing decisions are solid and he will take his walks. But are you particularly excited about the swing or the contact or the pop that he has?
Yeah, I mean, the strike zone discipline is outstanding. It's one of the higher walk guys in the minor leagues. You know, like you said, he doesn't pretty rarely chases. It's not a guy who's going to expand the strike zone. I think there are other, you know, the hit and the power are solid, but the patience is his best attribute. And sometimes, I mean, it's a good thing to be an extremely selective hitter, but sometimes when guys are extremely selective hitters in the lower levels of the minor leagues, and that's, you know, their best attribute, sometimes that catches up to them in higher levels where it, you know, the pitchers just have better command. They throw more strikes. It's not as easy to just get on base by drawing walks against guys in low A and high A as it is once you get to, you know, triple A and in the big league. So I think if he can catch, he has the offensive ability to, like, if you told me, all right, he's guaranteed he will definitely catch in the big leagues, then yeah, I would still have him top 100, but the defensive concerns I have are greater for me than the offensive ones.
Even if you are guaranteed that catching piece, would you still want him lower than we currently have him?
Yeah, I'd probably have him lower, but yeah, I could still see him being in the top 100.
Okay. Yeah, that all makes sense to me.
Some other hitters. Let's go to the pitching side. I mean, the obvious one who I think needs to move down is just Ricky Tiedemann, who unfortunately can't seem to stay healthy.
Don't let Jeff hear us talking about this. It's Jeff's guy, Ricky Tiedemann. But it's a bummer. I mean, he's dealt with a number of issues. We don't have the results on his MRI currently, do we? I know he's, like, last I had heard, he had elbow discomfort and was getting an MRI.
The Blue Jays have not sent it to me yet, no.
I didn't know if it was public yet, Ben. I know they're listening to you. But yeah, I mean, this is has always been the big question when he's on the mound and when he's actually pitching. It's elite stuff from the left side. It's phenomenal. He misses a ton of bats, but he just hasn't been healthy. Even when he has been healthy, we've had questions about, like, how long is he actually going to work through a game. So just adding yet another injury or injury question to the mix is unfortunate. It's hard to really know what's going to be Ricky's future at this point. I don't know what to think about him, because, like, yes, if he's going to be on the field, we know he's going to throw good stuff and he's going to be impactful, but we just have not seen that in any sort of consistent basis in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, 22, he threw 78 innings. Last year, it was 44 innings plus, you know, four starts in the fall league too. But at this point, again, the injury.
And he also wasn't throwing strikes when he was on the mound. I mean, part of that could be maybe he was dealing with the injury prior to, like, actually getting on the IL, but, like, watching him earlier this year, he didn't really know where the ball was going. So
yeah, strikes are definitely an issue this year. They were an issue last year. I mean, ERA is what it is. It was a 5.06 ERA last year in Double A. He walked 20 and 32 innings in Double A last year too. So it's yeah, a combination of control, but especially just the injury history between this year. He had the shoulder soreness before. He had the biceps sprain too. I just think everything medically is pointing to somebody who's probably going to be better suited to a relief role than a starter long term. And I mean, look, he was a darling of a lot of scouts and just a lot of people in baseball last year, because I don't think anybody should question the stuff that he has.
No, not at all.
Because the stuff when he's out there and healthy and throwing, I mean, the Blue Jays certainly protected him or monitored his workload very, very carefully and had him throwing very short stint outings. And again, he still had trouble staying healthy through that, which is another red flag. But when he's healthy, I mean, it's dynamite stuff. It's a starter's repertoire: fastball, slider, changeup. Like, you throw three pluses or better grades on all of it. But I think there's a, I just think one of the biggest biases we have just in the industry is overrating like what we see and what is staring us directly in the face when we're, you know, whether we're at a game or watching video or looking at the data even, and overlooking what isn't so readily obvious to us, which in this case is, you know, the medical red flags here. It's easy to get excited about, and I do too, about a guy who has the kind of stuff that Ricky Tiedemann has, but I just think everything is indicating he's somebody who, and he could end up being a really good reliever, but I think everything is pointing to somebody who's probably going to be better suited for a relief role than somebody who's going to be able to throw, you know, even like 120, 150 innings as a starter.
Yeah. I mean, it could easily be the case where in that more limited usage in each individual outing, he can be the best version of himself. Just allow that elite stuff to play. The refined command is not as much of an issue when you don't need to go as deep into games. And maybe you could argue about like the usage of relievers, whether or not that's better or worse for your health. But I think that everything you laid out there is spot on, and definitely something I tried to account for more than I have in the past this year, with just not quite being as aggressive on especially pitchers with significant injury questions. And another guy that you might have questions about too, and a guy that I love to bring up on this podcast, but Dylan Lesko, that's a guy who like a month ago, 2 months ago, I regretted where I was on him, like not pushing him up as high as like probably my heart wanted me to, but
I think number three overall would probably be a little rich, no?
Yeah, three would definitely be a little bit rich. But Lesko, I mean, there was some buzz in spring training because he had this new slider. My expectation this year is we'd see a return with the command that he had in high school, and we'd just start to see him put all of his really impressive stuff together. Hasn't quite been the case for him. He's still been pretty erratic. It's a good ERA so far through three starts, 3.00 ERA in 12 innings, but he's struck out 11 batters and he's walked 10. So certainly that touch and feel that I came to know and love is not back here with Dylan Lesko yet. So how concerned would you be with a guy like him who is not injured, but certainly has not rediscovered his like elite status form that he had pre-Tommy John surgery just yet?
I'm growing more concerned because I think last year you look at it and you're like, all right, well, he's just coming back from Tommy John surgery. Maybe he's not 100% and still heard good things about the stuff. It's only 33 innings. You know, command sometimes can take longer to come back after Tommy John. But now we're in year two and it's 10 walks and 12 innings. It's only 12 innings. He's only faced 47 batters. I don't want to overreact, but it is more building evidence of, was this what we saw last year? Was that just a temporary thing where he was walking six batters per nine in his return? Or is this actually going to be a bigger issue? I thought, or at least was optimistic last year that, all right, it's really the Tommy John surgery coming back from that. He's still not 100%. Because he was so good in terms of his command and strike throwing relative to a high school pitcher, at least going into the draft. I mean, that was one of the big things for him. I mean, he had really good stuff, but the other thing was he could spot it up really well for a high school pitcher. But, whether it's just the difference between high school and pro ball, or it is just maybe who he is now after TJ, I don't know, but I'm starting to get a little bit more concerned here.
Yeah, early on, he's definitely not been locating the fastball and changeup specifically like he previously has been. Both of those pitches have been a lot more erratic. Watching a few of his games, it sort of looks like he rushes his delivery at times, particularly with the fastball. He does have this new pitch kind of like a harder breaking ball, mid-80s slider. Sometimes it gets labeled as a cutter. I don't know if it's a slider and a cutter or if it's just a hard slider that kind of blends between the two. But that has been an encouraging pitch for him to get in the zone, and is a pitch that I was intrigued with because previously Lesko had like a very low usage curveball that had really impressive spin rates, but it was this kind of 12-6, maybe 11-5 depthy breaking ball that is typically a pitch that is not being landed in the zone more consistently. And I wondered if he'd be a guy who adopts a slider, because so many pitchers who can spin the baseball do adopt sliders. But he's got this new pitch, and he has been in the zone more frequently with that one. But certainly the fastball command has to improve. The changeup still looks like a really impressive swing and miss pitch for him, but that like command piece that makes it a legitimate 70 offering is not quite there. I'm kind of with you. Like, I'm not sure how long you need to give a pitcher like Lesko away from TJ before you can really say, okay, like, this doesn't have anything to do with the rehabbing. It's just like, maybe he won't have that touch and feel again moving forward. It's not the same as a guy like Mackenzie Gore, because it wasn't injury related, I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, but I remember Mackenzie Gore being this really polished pitcher coming out of high school as well, probably the second best high school pitcher that I've seen in person after Dylan Lesko. And he went through stages where he really just lost feel for the zone and how to throw strikes. And this year, it seems like he's figuring that out. So maybe it's just a case where sometimes it can take a while to come back. But I'm still like optimistic because I can see the stuff with Lesko. But he's certainly not the same pitcher that he was when he was drafted just yet. And I really hope he can get back to that version, because it is really special when it's all on.
Yeah, I mean, watching him this year, the changeup is still a phenomenal pitch. I mean, it's coming 13, 14 miles an hour off of his fastball. It's not because he's slowing his arm speed either. I mean, it's just parachutes at the plate. It's a lot of deception, maintains his arm speed, just kills spin on the pitch too. So I think that can still be a, you know, plus pitch for him. He's got really high spin on his curveball when he is throwing it. Obviously it's, you know, still mostly fastball changeup for him, but obviously the strike throwing has got to be the big thing that steps forward for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Who else we got?
How about token
Lesko mentioned out of the way and in more depth than usual too. So that was fun.
How about where are you at right now on Hurston Waldrip, the Braves first round pick from last year? Because right now, they sent him to Double A.
Yeah.
13 innings, especially that first really rough start, but 13 innings. He's allowed 23 hits, 11 runs. He's walked 6, 12 strikeouts. Where are you at on Hurston Waldrip?
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit more skeptical with Hurston Waldrip than a guy like Lesko. I mean, part of it is just because I was my highest on Lesko was higher than I was with Waldrip, so maybe just like easier to come off a guy that you never loved quite that much. But Hurston Waldrip was really good last year, and so far this year he's been hit around pretty significantly. I think the one thing with Waldrip that jumps out is, even though he throws hard, I'm not sure if he's thrown exactly as hard as he did in college. Like the velo, he's averaging around 94 with the fastball. I think that's around, he might have been a little bit harder in Florida going every 7 days or so. But man, hitters have really teed off on the fastball. And I think that is an important pitch for him, because the splitter is a pitch that he's just not been able to consistently locate in zone. And so if your fastball, which theoretically is the pitch that you're going to be using to establish the strike zone and let the splitter play off it, if hitters just are not fooled by that pitch and not fazed by that pitch, all of a sudden it becomes really hard to get ahead in counts and get into situations where you can deploy that really nasty split change and use it effectively. Because I don't think that pitch in general is a pitch that pitchers are able to get ahead in counts with. It feels like more like a finishing pitch. And certainly for Hurston Waldrip, who already had control question marks to begin with, doesn't feel like that's the sort of pitch he can use it for. So I have a lot of questions at this stage, and mostly just because of seeing the results on the pitch. Like, our Stuff Plus model that we have from Dylan White doesn't really like the fastball. I know there were some critiques about like the shape of the fastball, his arm angle, it's really over the top. Maybe that's just hitters can pick it up a little bit more despite the velocity. I don't know, but there are certainly some question marks that I have with Waldrop at this stage.
Yeah, I love his splitter. But yeah, like you said, it's the fastball's definitely been getting hit this year. Talked about command issues with Dylan Lesko. I think that's always been a concern too with Hurst and Waldrop. Do you think long-term he fits better as a starter, or do you think there's significant relief risk here?
Probably significant relief risk. I mean, I'm trying to pull up my report on him this offseason to see how much we were encouraged just with the pro debut, how good he was moving up the ladder. And he actually did throw a decent amount of strikes. I know the Braves have a pretty good track record of just helping guys throw more strikes, but he always had more reliever risk, I think, than AJ Smith-Shawver. And that was part of the reason that Smith-Shawver ranked number one in the system and Waldrop ranked number two, is just the reliever risk that comes from Waldrop. But he did make some improvements with his tempo and his delivery last year. I'm not sure if that has fallen off or it's just some other issue. But yeah, I think just the pitch mix specifically, his control and command overall feels like a better fit for the bullpen now, and certainly the early results don't give you a ton of confidence. I don't know though. It's only three starts, like see what happens, but just if the fastball is playing a little bit better, I'd be more encouraged. But we had the fastball not playing, the command questions, like I don't know what you think about the slider. That pitch was good in the past, but it just feels like he's very limited right now if the control doesn't take a huge step forward.
Yeah, I just look where we have him right now at number 49 on our top 100, and I think there's still a lot of things to be really excited about. But I would also have him, I think it's pretty significantly lower than where we have him right now at 49.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that as well. And I also think AJ Smith-Shawver hasn't exactly been great to start the year. He's thrown three starts, and it's not a deal. I know the Atlanta pitchers, both those two, they didn't really get positive reports from scouts in spring training. So it really sounds like for both those guys, it's kind of been a tough year at the early going. And those are the only two guys we had for that system in the top 100. So a bad farm system looking maybe a little worse a few months in.
Yeah. Although Owen Murphy pitching extremely well.
He has been really good. We touched on him a little in last week's episode. If you want to listen to that, he's got some really fun traits with the fastball, and his field has been the breaking balls.
Yeah.
Fastball shape, I should say.
Well, all right. I'll give you a guy. Can we talk about a guy who I am excited about, though?
Tired of pouring cold water on prospects?
Yeah, not a top 100 guy, but I think, again, like all these, you can hear, all right, all these guys we're talking about, we have to hedge everything because it's only been 2-3 starts for most of these guys, right? I mean, in Tiedemann's case, there's, you know, a significant new injury that I think has a material impact on his projection going forward. But, with a lot of these guys, we're not going off a ton of new information yet. Like we're still in pretty small sample size territory, but there are some guys where we have seen significant jumps in their stuff. And one guy we've seen that from is Bishop Letson, who the Brewers drafted last year. What do you know about Bishop Letson, Carlos? Yeah,
Bishop Letson last year, he was a guy, I think we ranked him somewhere in the middle of the 500, but he was a late rising pitcher who had basically started touching a little bit more velocity, flashed some stuff, but had a little bit of effort in the delivery. I think projectable, kind of lean, skinny kid. But there were some questions about the strike throwing, and how polished he was as a pure pitcher, but he was ticking up prior to the draft. I think he took a little bit of velo jump in the spring, but he was certainly not like a prominent prep name coming into that draft.
Yeah, like you said, he's 6'4", 170 pounds, super lanky kid who had a lot of arm speed, pretty loose arm, just a lot of those projection boxes that you're looking for as a scout to look at and think, all right, well, this guy's going to – we think this guy, or we hope this guy will throw harder. Sometimes those guys do, and sometimes they don't, or maybe just a little bit more velocity comes. But in his case, it's come on pretty quickly this year. So he, you know, at the time of the draft, he was touching 93. And then this year is really the first time he's come out and thrown in pro ball. And like, I don't know if you have like the numbers in front of you, but you know, nothing that probably jumps off the page. It's
If you want me to run the numbers through, I can. I don't know if
Go ahead.
Yeah, he's got a 1.59 ERA, two starts, 5.2 innings, eight strikeouts, and five walks.
Yeah, but I think his stock is going to go up like pretty significantly, because we've already seen his stuff go from touching 93 last year in the draft when the Brewers drafted him in the 11th round to where he's now sitting around 93. I mean, it's about 92, 95, and he's been up to 98. So we're talking about a jump of like
that 5 mile per hour jump in peak velocity is pretty encouraging. Even if you wanted to say, oh, it's only been a couple innings, like him just getting to that top end heat is really loud.
Yeah, he's basically sitting where he used to top out at in high school. And he's flashing a pretty good slider too. I think it has a chance to be a, you know, maybe a plus pitch. He's showing feel for a changeup too.
Stuff Plus definitely has it as a plus pitch. The metrics love the slider at this stage.
The eyes do too. At least my eyes do. So again, he's only like the Brewers. He's not working through a lineup a second time. It's two starts. It's 5 2/3 innings. But we are seeing a pretty material uptick in his stuff so far. So I think, again, it's 5 walks, 5 2/3 innings, or 5 1/3, whatever it is. So we'll see. It's too early to say anything about the strikes yet. But
yep.
He was a projection arm where you hoped at some point he'd put on more weight and strength, and we'd see the fastball jump. And now we're seeing it. And I mean, I don't know how high he's going to end up ranking when our new Brewers top 30 comes out, because that's still a pretty strong Brewers farm system. So there's a lot of pretty good arms ahead of him. But I mean, if they redo the draft today, like, I mean, he signed for a little longer.
Basically signed for fifth round money, like early fifth round money.
Yeah. A little under 500,000, like that. This kind of guy is not getting less than $1 million now.
Yeah. It's a pretty big jump in pure stuff. And I will be intrigued to see like what sort of a pitcher he winds up being in year one. And maybe he's not the guy you'd expect to just add a ton of polish alongside that velocity immediately. Still a few years for him to kind of learn how to pitch at the pro level. But if you're a Brewers fan, you have to be really excited about the stuff you're able to find, like you said, in the 11th round. That's a good one.
Yeah, and I like seeing teams draft guys like that too. It's where maybe the raw stuff isn't there right now, but you see all of those projection arrows that are pointing in the right way, and they could take that leap forward if just with size and strength gains, or maybe other mechanical adjustments that allow them to get into their, you know, their legs or hips more, whatever, you know, hinging, all that stuff that teams try to do to squeeze a little extra velocity out of guys. But it's tough, right? Because sometimes you bet on that guy and then they go out and sometimes they put on weight and they still don't throw harder. But I do like seeing teams being able to add those guys. It's just sometimes those guys want a lot of money to not get to college, because they're thinking the players are saying the same thing. Yeah. Once I go to college, I'll be, you know, bigger, faster, stronger. My stuff will be better. I'll be throwing harder and I'll be able to, you know, get more money 3 years later.
Yeah.
In the draft.
I'm entirely with you. I love when teams take shots on players like this, like balls of clay types who are really not refined in any capacity, but you getting in early and kind of helping them along that developmental path could pay off in a big way. It does feel like less and less of those players are taken in the draft just because the window, the amount of time teams might feel like they have, like they're able to give to one player is probably a lot less than it previously was, just given the amount of spots in the minor leagues. I know more and more teams just feel like they can't afford to invest in a lot of players like this because they're so limited. So we've seen teams trending more towards the college demographic on the whole. And so the teams that are still willing to do this and invest significant money in players like this, it is always encouraging. And hopefully that this like player type and profile doesn't die out entirely. I know a lot of scouts really lament the fact that there are fewer options to take players like this, some smaller drafts, smaller minor league system. It's tricky, but it is nice to see when it actually does happen.
Yeah, and he was not a guy who was big on the radar, even for college coaches, when he was going through the recruiting process. I mean, he committed to Purdue, which not like Purdue's not usually concerned about losing their recruits to the draft.
Yeah,
put it that way. Like, so he was, yeah, again, he was top in 93 as a high school senior, and even by then, that was a jump up from the time he had committed to Purdue as an underclassman. So yeah, I think it's just tough, and you have your bonus pool restrictions in the draft, so it's harder, like you said, to take chances on those guys. It's easier, it's almost like there's more guys like that in Latin America where you know, again, they're even a lot of those guys are signing for small bonuses, but you at least have more of an opportunity to get those deeper projection plays into your system when they're, you know, still, you know, whether it's 16, 17, 18 years old, the Dominican Republic kid who's, you know, 6'4", 6'5", 175 pounds, who has a ton of strength projection there, has some good arrows pointing the right way. If you think those, you know, the strength gains will come on and there's more velocity in the tank, that'll come. But it's harder to, it's not like those guys are leaving baseball in the States or just going to college baseball, but it's harder for, I think, teams to get those guys out of high school now.
Yeah, so maybe if you're a college fan, you celebrate that. You get more talent to campus than you previously were. So if you're really invested in the metal bats, then congratulations. All right, any other players you want to touch on, Ben, as big jumpers or risers or guys you're concerned about?
I mean, those are some of the main names that I had. Did you have anybody else or...
No, those are fun ones to go through. I didn't have any other specific names, so I'm good. Want to get to a listener question we have?
Well, I wanted to ask you about some draft stuff too, because we had the
sure. Let's do it.
Yeah, the draft update came out. I saw your mock draft came out too. It does seem like there's a group of, like you said, eight college players that have really separated themselves at the top of the draft this year. So I'm wondering about the teams that are picking outside of the top eight, because if you're, you know, picking in the top eight, you at least have guaranteed access to one of those guys if you want them. But I'm wondering about the teams picking nine through 12, right? So like the Pirates at 9, the Nationals at 10, the Tigers at 11, the Red Sox at 12. So I guess I'll start with the Pirates at 9. Is there a player in that top eight who you feel like has the best chance of maybe falling out of the top eight picks among those eight college players? Or, you know, obviously we have Connor Griffin, the top high school player in the country at number 9. Is that somebody who would be a potential fit for the Pirates, or do you think they would go in a different direction?
Yeah, a couple questions there. First of all, I'd say the two most likely, and I tried to ask as many people as I could about this, like teams picking in the middle of the first round and beyond, like which of those players in the eight, even if you assume they're going to be gone, which do you think are most likely to slide out? And pretty consistently, I would say the two that were brought up were JJ Weatherholt and Nick Kurtz. And I think it's because of the injury for JJ Weatherholt, the hammy, just the fact that he hasn't played as often as those other players. Hasn't had a chance to go nuclear like Condon and Bazzana and Montgomery and Caglione have. And then with Kurtz, you have the injury, the slow start. I don't know how much we need to belabor his slow start because he looks pretty good in terms of what he's done overall. But Nick Kurtz probably has the like least exciting defensive profile of the players in the top eight. So those two, at least as of like last week when I was checking in with a bunch of people throughout the industry, seem to be most likely to slide to the back end or slide out. And even though we're saying like top eight, it would be unsurprising for someone to slide out because we always see players slide every draft year. So those two, I'd say right now, and maybe that's unsurprising because we have them ranked 7 and 8. So it's not like a huge, huge leap. And then with Connor Griffin, with Pittsburgh specifically, I actually think he makes, for me, I think he makes a lot of sense with that farm system. They have a lot of pitchers. A lot of the hitters they've targeted are kind of hitterish, contact first, or at least were. I don't know if Tamar Johnson really counts as that now, but I think adding an athlete with a bunch of tools like Connor Griffin to that farm system would actually kind of diversify some of the talent you have at the top end. And I think they probably could be due for a really upside type hitting prospect to layer onto all the pitchers they're producing. So I think that would be a lot of fun in their farm system. I'm not sure if they as an organization like prefer their high school players to have maybe a little bit more confidence in a hit tool. Like, it wouldn't shock me if they were more into a Bryce Rayner because of that. He's been really good on the hitting front. I mean, Connor Griffin and Bryce Rayner have both been really good. But I think the Connor Griffin one could actually make a lot of sense for Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So you think Nick Kurtz could be somebody who'd still be there for them?
I mean, yeah, based on people I've been talking to, he was a name that was floated as a guy who could. I mean, if you've got teams up top that are really dinging him because of his medical track record, he's dealt with shoulder issue a few times. He's dealt with a rib issue. I think he's had health stuff going back to high school. So on draft day, when teams are looking over all this medical stuff, that always comes up, and you look at him too, and he's a first base profile with Weatherholt play middle infield, with Braden Montgomery, you got a guy who can play probably all three outfield positions. With Charlie Condon, you got a guy who's played five. With Bazzana, you've got an up the middle player. So I think, yeah, relative to the other players, and as of today, he does seem like probably towards the bottom end, even if I really love the offensive profile all around with him.
Yeah, if I'm the Pirates and Nick Kurtz is available at number nine,
you took him in our staff draft, so we know you're all over him, Ben. Weatherholt.
I would be all over Nick Kurtz. I think it's a pretty complete offensive profile. I mean, he is a first baseman, yeah, but I think the offensive upside is there to be an above average regular at first base. It's patience, contact, power.
Mm-hmm. In this draft class, like if you're picking 7 or 8, I imagine you have to feel thrilled with whoever gets to you, because like the difference in Kurtz and Weatherholt and guys like Bazzana and Caglione at the top, I don't think there's any difference, and some of them have to go in front of you. So whoever you end up with, you should be in a good spot. It seems like a good draft to be picking 6 to 8, maybe not a great draft to be picking 9 to 12. Maybe I'd say like 10 to 12, maybe, because I do think Griffin is close enough to where he could count in that range. And I think he's got a lot more upside than a lot of the players that are going to go in front of him, just whether or not you have that risk tolerance.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to draft for need, but I don't think Pirates fans are. I think if they draft Nick Kurtz, then you're just going to have to deal with questions of how soon can he come up and replace Rowdy Tellez, because I don't think he's making a lot of fans in Pittsburgh right now. He's,
oof. Yeah, it maybe would be fun to get a fast mover with the Pirates' new wave of talent. They got a lot of upper minors talent that are kind of about to make their impacts on the big league team, so maybe a quick mover would be great for them.
All right. Well, what about the Nationals at 10? What would be like a potential best-case scenario or possibilities for them at 10?
Best-case scenario, Charlie Condon falls to 10.
You think that's... Yeah, I mean, that...
You said best-case scenario, didn't you?
I mean, I don't
know. Pretty good outfield. Charlie Condon, James Wood, Dylan Cruz. Gotta like that.
What would Charlie Condon have to do to be available at number 10? Something.
Oh, man.
Something horrendous.
Commit a crime, yeah.
Yeah, definitely a crime of some sort.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Washington will be interesting too, because they've got new decision makers over there in the draft department. Brad Cielik from Baltimore is now with the Nationals. Just some new people in there, so it'll be interesting to see whether or not they change like draft strategy, I'd say. Like in the past, they've been all over guys like Connor Griffin, like toolsy physical athletes with upside. Maybe in that same lens, a guy like Bryce Rainer, toolsy, athletic, pretty physical now. They seem to like big players, big physical players. They've taken power, arms. Like I don't think a guy like Treya Savage is like a prototypical Nationals pitching prospect by any means, but I also think like in this range with all these teams here, you really have to consider a guy like Treya Savage. The trio of Savage, Griffin, Rainer, they almost form like a little tier two for me with how much positive feedback they've been getting, how they performed. Bryce Rainer performed at the NHSI in front of scouts, did well there. Connor Griffin has dominated the competition. Treya Savage has been probably the most consistent pitcher in the class, not named Chase Burns or Hagen Smith. Like all these three right here, I think are favorites to be off the board next. That's why we have them ranked where we do, and that's why I had them mocked where we had them. But I would be happy with all of these guys in this range.
Yeah, the only thing is with the Orioles, they never really went. I mean, I guess going back to Grayson Rodriguez in 2018, they did take a pitcher, and a lot of the picks were at the very, very top of the draft. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like they went very hitter heavy in those drafts. And obviously your first round pick, particularly when you're picking, you know, top five overall, is more than just the scouting director making that call. But I wonder if they're going to go or at least lean more, be more inclined to take a hitter with that pick.
Yeah. I mean, I think the top of this draft should be very hitter heavy. Savage is like the one pitcher who makes sense. Every other player that I think makes sense in this range is a bat. So if you wanted to say you need to be hitter heavy if you're picking at the top of the first, I think a lot of teams have employed that strategy and it's worked. So I wouldn't fault you for it.
Yeah. Do you think there's a chance that whether it's Kurtz, Weatherholt, maybe even Braden Montgomery, is there a chance any of those guys could be still available for the Nationals?
Sure. Why not? I mean, it really only takes one player sliding and one player going in this range on like an underslot deal who is maybe a little bit surprising for that to happen. Like it is very hard to rule any of these players sliding out in April, I would say, for a spot just two or three spots below like the top eight. So yeah, like you shouldn't write them off just because we're saying it's a top eight tier. Don't write any of these players off. Like in 2021, the Diamondbacks probably didn't think they were going to get access to Jordan Lawler, who is number one on our board and in this kind of top five grouping, and fell to six. Like they went over slot to get him, but he was still available there to be picked.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, do you think for you, would it be surprising? Because for me, it's just very hard to write anyone off.
I think more likely there's somebody who, yeah, maybe not slide, but somebody else comes in on an underslot deal, mm-hmm. With one of the picks ahead of them. Maybe it's a team that really likes high school players, mm-hmm. Or like you said, you know, Nick Kurtz is available. Oh, I don't want to draft a guy who's going to be limited to first base or DH, or again, you have medical concerns with JJ Weatherholt, or, you know, hopefully he comes back and plays more in the rest of the season. But if he gets hurt again and he doesn't really play a lot, yeah, that's going to be an issue. I mean, the other obvious thing that I hope doesn't happen is, you know, one of the two big arms, Burns or Smith, either gets hurt or there's something in their medical too that causes them to slip and they could be available. But then that's like, you know, obviously a different story of whether, you know, them being hurt at that time would be a different calculation compared to where they are right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about, I mean, the Tigers, they seem to really, they pick at 11 overall. They seem to kind of switch up some of their philosophy last year in the draft. What are they looking at here that could be available at number 11?
Well, I had them mocked with Bryce Rainer in this one. Best high school hitter available. I mean, Mark Connor in the past with the Padres has really liked tools, it seems like. But last year, they also targeted two players with really advanced hit tools, contact ability. So if that's something they're really looking for in this range, it might be something that is either not available or you have to go a little bit further down the board to get it. Like a guy like James Tibbs is maybe the best like pure hitter on the board here. And that's a tough profile defensively too. Like it seems high at 11 to take a guy like Tibbs, but I mean, he's been getting significant up arrow feedback. We have him kind of right in the middle of the first round. So maybe going towards the upper end of that middle first round range isn't crazy. But yeah, you're looking at kind of your first tier of these, like, or not your first tier, your second tier college hitters, and your second tier high school players at this range, I would imagine. So it's kind of a wide pool of players who all fit and make sense, but none that maybe you're really excited about. And especially compared to 2023, when you're looking at guys like Matt Shaw and Tommy Troy and Braden Taylor, you had more high school shortstops than just the one in Bryce Rayner. So if he's not on the board, like, do you really have a shortstop you can feel confident in? Maybe it's a guy like Seaver King, although like if hit tool and hitting conviction and approach is what you wanted, like it's maybe his biggest question mark. He's more like toolsy and explosive. So yeah, it's really wide open in this range.
Yeah, if James Tibbs, Florida State, 401, 503, 842 this year, more than 30 walks to 14 strikeouts, so more than twice as many walks as strikeouts, and more home runs, 17, and strikeouts too. Is he somebody, it seems like he's somebody this year where just in a class overall, once you get past those top eight or so college hitters in a class that otherwise seems to lack a lot of pure hitters. If you're looking for somebody like that, it seems like he has a good chance to maybe go higher than you might think in a normal draft, just because of the conviction it sounds like teams will have in his hitting ability, even though it's, you know, some defensive limitations.
Yeah, he reminds me, I don't know if this is a good comparison, but the player that I think of when I think about James Tibbs is Trevor Larnach from the 2018 draft, I believe, out of Oregon State. He was a guy who was kind of this bat-first power hitter with defensive and profile questions, but I think he went a little bit earlier than I expected at the time, and I think that profile in this class is just probably going to go even higher just because of the relative weakness of the class, and it is more typical for the bats to get pushed up the board because you really want to just... If you get anything with a hitter, you want to feel confident in the hit and power combo. And I think it will probably be more likely for area guys who've seen James Tibbs a lot to be on the lower end for him because they've seen him play defense poorly for a long time. And maybe your national checkers, your scouting directors, certainly your people in the front office who are looking at the batted ball data and really keying in on that. Like I would say, like on paper and performance-wise, Tibbs probably looks better than he does if you're watching him every day, just because, again, you can see the fielding more upfront, obviously. But again, like if hitting is the most important thing, Tibbs is as close to a confident lock as you might have in the middle of the first round. And so I wouldn't fault a team for jumping on that bat either.
Yeah, I think somebody who really values his hitting ability and strike zone discipline could certainly take him earlier than we would have thought coming into the year.
Although maybe not as early as Peter. Peter has long been a big James Tibbs fan, so nice to him. And one of his other guys, Walker Yannick, catcher at Sam Houston State, he's also been an up arrow prospect. I actually like Walker Yannick quite a bit and wonder if he could work his way into this middle of the first round range. I haven't heard him talked about quite as high as where we're at now on the board, like at Detroit at 11. But he's a pretty well-rounded player, having a great year, and maybe is the best catcher in the class. I know a lot of people don't seem to like catchers in the first round because it is often not a really sexy profile, but it's a pretty high likely big leaguer in my opinion. So that would be a fun one too.
How about the Red Sox pick at 12? Is this too soon to kind of start to write off the likelihood of one of these top eight college guys still being available there? I mean, how many underslot players could go ahead of them that would cause somebody like a Weatherholt or a Kurtz to get to them?
Like, this is probably the range where you start to be like, yeah, if JJ Weatherholt is here at 12 or if Nick Kurtz is here at 12, like, doesn't feel really possible. Just like you said, a lot of things seem to happen in this range. So, yeah, feels unlikely. maybe potential nightmare scenario for Red Sox or maybe Red Sox fans. I'm hearing a lot of on Twitter, like, it sounds like they really want an arm. They want to supplement their hitting farm system with a pitching prospect. Nightmare scenario for them could be Burns is off the board. Smith is off the board. Trey Savage is off the board. After that, like, there's not a pitching prospect that makes a lot of sense to me on talent at 12. Like, everyone I'm looking at is hitters. And if you're a Red Sox fan and you're tired of drafting hitters, maybe you don't love that scenario, but you still have some players with tools and athleticism. They just signed, or they just extended, Sadane Rafaela. There's a guy, Vance Honeycutt, UNC outfielder, who I have mocked to them in the most recent edition, who, I mean, I don't think they're similar players, but Vance Honeycutt has pure hit tool and contact questions, but is a phenomenal defender with power, with speed. So there's some similarities there. And if Boston is confident in Rafaela, maybe they could like a guy like Honeycutt as well. Even though, again, like, Honeycutt is going to be a very polarizing player. Like, I know there are some people who think he'd be one of the first players off the board after this top eight grouping. And I know some other teams and scouts who wouldn't want him until later in the first, or maybe even after the first, just because maybe he can do it this year, but as of right now, he hasn't hit 300 over a full season. The strikeout rate is pushing closer to 30%. So there are some question marks there, but in terms of tools and athleticism, Vance Honeycutt should be one of the top players in the class, but the pure hitting ability has just never been there to support that.
Do you think Connor Griffin could be available here?
Sure.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. Like, if it just keeps going really college heavy, it only takes, like, again, if the top eight go how they do, like, Connor Griffin's biggest question is, like, what is the degree of, like, impact with the pure hitting ability? Like, how good is a swing? How good of a hitter is he really going to be? And if Pittsburgh, Washington, Detroit are all maybe a little bit more skeptical and would feel better with a Savage or a Rainer, who's a lot closer to Griffin today than he was at the start of the amateur season, or Honeycutt, or a guy like Tibbs, like, yeah, I think it'd be pretty easy to envision a scenario like that. And then you're looking at maybe accessing the highest upside hitter in the class.
Yeah, I mean, Bryce Rainer would certainly fit the Red Sox quota for Southern California.
SoCal shortstops, yeah.
Yeah, middle infielder. For pitching, though, could you see an underslot deal for somebody like is it too early for like a William Schmidt, who we have at 18, right-handed pitcher from Louisiana, or a Cam Caminiti, another LSU commit who we have ranked, you know, like a back of the first round right now on talent? Could you see somebody doing maybe an underslot deal for them?
Yeah. I guess
if you're looking for pitching.
It feels weird to think about a guy like William Schmidt going sooner than Noble Meyer did last year. But again, it's a different class, different competition. Maybe you just have to think back to guys like Frank Mazzucato, who had an underslot deal and went earlier than we would have expected. He was further off the board than where we have Schmidt and Caminiti at this point. I think there are also some other northern arms that are maybe tracking upward that you could think about as underslot deals in the first, but it definitely feels more common for teams to take those guys later and pay them more than take a high school pitcher on an underslot deal. But it has happened. So, I mean, I can't with confidence say that it's like not going to happen. So sure. But.
Yeah. I think I'm very curious to see who will still be available for the Red Sox when they pick it 12, because it does seem like
I think the Red Sox are very curious about that as well.
Well, yeah, that's understandable, but yeah, because I think it's going to be tough to get one of these top eight college players again, unless there's an injury to one of these arms. Not ruling it out entirely, but you'd have to have a series of underslot guys going ahead of him, or one of these guys would have to really, really tumble somehow. In which case, you know, then it becomes a different calculation again. Like the guy, if I were them, who I'd be really excited to get if he's there, would be Trey Savage, who you mentioned at ECU. I think he's, like you said, he's established himself now as the number three pitcher in the class behind Chase Burns and Hagen Smith. Just strike thrower, starter stuff, good fastball, an array of swing and miss secondary pitches with him as well. You know, like you said, a farm system that needs pitching. Their pitching in the big leagues has been, they've had some good success or early successes this yeah. season in terms of guys taking some jumps forward.
The lineup they're running out, you'd think they need hitting help, but it doesn't seem to be the case in their prospect capital, at least.
Oh, they have Yoshida coming off the bench. They're
$90 million part-time DH.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, but no, I think I might have even put Yesavage with the Red Sox at 12, but I really couldn't justify him being on the board at that point in this most recent mock because he has been so good. And like again, I think the dynamics, like the lack of college pitchers who have posted and performed consistently this year, like Ben Hess not being good, despite every scout loving Ben Hess and wanting to take him high, like Josh Hartle being bad, Brody Brecht not throwing strikes, Jonathan Santucci not throwing strikes, like all these guys who seem to fit somewhere in the first round, in the middle of the first round, pushing up in the first round, have not posted. And I think college pitching is a very coveted demographic in the draft, especially from like the top end decision makers, the GMs. They love just being able to take a college pitcher, a guy who they feel confident can move quickly and help the team, because it's just so expensive to find those guys. Some of them break. They want to take that demographic. And I think that's going to be fantastic news for Trey Yesavage, because once the top two are gone, you look around, like he is the guy at this point. So it feels difficult to see him sliding down the board too far.
Yeah, I wonder if teams are going to look at it more and say, yeah, these guys do break. Why would we take a pitcher?
Yeah, I had this exact conversation with a scout last week, actually, and I think it's almost a bit of a paradox, because you could argue it either way based on the same logic and say pitchers break all the time, therefore we should never draft pitchers. Or you could say pitchers break all the time, therefore we should draft more pitchers. Like, both of them make sense to me. You still need someone to throw innings, and you have to account for the attrition. But you could also say, yeah, that's true, but with my first round pick, I don't want to use that capital on someone who could break. So it's very tricky, and I'm glad I'm not a decision maker having to decide on taking an arm like that.
Well, there's the injuries, but then there's also, yeah, we can also develop arms in the later rounds probably better than we can hitters. But
can every team do that is the question. I'm sure some teams don't feel very confident they can. If you're the Mariners or the Twins or the Brewers, the Guardians, you probably feel pretty good about that. But I have to imagine not every single team feels good about it. Maybe every pitching coach with every team feels good, but I don't know about every decision maker, every GM.
Yeah. But I think if you're could you see a path, or I mean I certainly could, where if you're looking for pitching, where Trey Yesavage is still available at number 12, because I think it's very likely those top eight college players will be gone. But then the Pirates pick at 9, you know, you have Connor Griffin going that route. If the Nationals want to go hitter, okay, that's kind of following the pattern that they,
yeah,
you know, the decision makers are now.
If you want.
Yeah, put him there. Maybe Tigers go hitter too. Some or there's another underslot deal mm-hmm. somewhere ahead of them, and then Trey Yesavage is there at number 12.
Sure, there you go. I mean, you can talk yourself into a lot of outcomes that make a lot of sense in these mocks. It's one thing I've learned over the years.
Well, nobody's going to be trading picks, that I can guarantee.
Well, thank goodness for my sanity as we get to draft day, I guess.
Worth it for me.
Would you trade out of the top eight? Let's say you're picking eight and the player available on the board is Nick Kurtz, and the Pirates really just want Nick Kurtz. Would you flip picks with them? What would you ask for to flip picks? One pick. So it's a slot value of pick eight comes with a 6.5 million slot value. Pick nine comes with a 6.2 million slot value, so $300,000 just in slot value. And then however you value the gap in Nick Kurtz and whoever your number nine player is. I assume that would be Connor Griffin for you, but I don't know that. So what do you think you would need to add to that just to flip one pick to get Kurtz if you're the Pirates?
I would want to – I'm curious to see what the trade market would be. Mm-hmm. I would want a pretty good prospect in return, though.
A pretty good prospect in return for moving up one spot.
Yeah,
like,
I think
how good is pretty good? Like a top 10 in your system? Like
I think, well, I'm part of it maybe just how high I am on Nick Kurtz. Like I would have I mean, if Condon, Bazana, after that, like, I don't know. I think you can make a case for Nick Kurtz at number three in this draft.
I think you could too.
So if he's still there at number, what do we say, number eight?
He's available at eight and you're trading out of the pick, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd still be, I'd be psyched to get Nick Kurtz there. And I think the
Paul
drop
Skeens
off.
Paul Skeens in pick number nine for Nick Kurtz.
Paul Skeens. Paul, yeah, I mean, he can't, well, I guess he did
pretty
go past
prospect.
The third inning today, so he's getting
yeah.
better.
The dude's got no durability. What can you do?
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is I don't know that the Pirates would be willing to give up the level of prospect that I would want to trade off that pick.
Well, the Pirates also feel like a team, this is literally just going off their 2021 draft maybe, but they seem like a team who would trade out of picks and take more of a portfolio approach. Again, that's literally just looking at their 2021 draft, so maybe not the case in this scenario. But yeah, the pick trading is fascinating, Ben. Glad it doesn't exist.
That's not the attitude to have, Carlos.
Yeah, I would want to watch it. I just know it'd be a pain for me, but it'd be a lot of fun on draft day.
All right. Want to get some listener questions?
Yeah, let's get into that. Right. We have one question today from Mets Perspective on Instagram, who I feel like gives us a lot of good questions. So
he does.
Shout out to Mets Perspective. Do academies in Latin America get in trouble when a player is found to have faked his age? It's a Ben Badler question, if I've ever heard one.
I would say it's pretty rare. I mean, the one, so I wouldn't necessarily just assume that, say, a player in the Dominican Republic is caught having falsified his, using falsified age or identity to try to sign with MLB team. I wouldn't just assume that the trainer at the academy where he was necessarily the one who's falsifying the documents or even necessarily knew himself. I mean, trainers get players from all over and sometimes, they just don't know. Like sometimes they're being fooled, whether it's somebody in the family changing documents themselves or somebody else earlier along in the process did it and they were unaware. So that does happen. At the same time, yeah, I think some of these guys are either directly involved or do know that the players that they've had sign have used false ages. I mean, there have been cases where trainers have had their own sons sign using false ages. So that definitely happens, but it's pretty rare, I would say, where I've ever heard of a trainer getting in trouble either with MLB or with the country they're in. I mean, typically the Dominican Republic, right? If I were MLB, I would think I would want to work with the government in the DR, where if somebody is committing a crime and is creating a problem in terms of your industry, you'd want to work with them, but yeah. Doesn't seem to really happen. So,
how much of a reputational cost is there? Or do you think that like the agents who are training the best talent, like you just kind of have to work with them? Like how much of it is just like, okay, the teams know that you're lying about this stuff, so what you say to them is maybe just less trustworthy. Is there any sort of reputational cost that comes with stuff like that is actually like impactful to a program?
Yeah, I think there are certainly the scouts who've been doing this for a while are definitely aware of the people who have reputations for either falsifying, having players who used falsified ages, or same thing with steroids too, and that includes players whether they were officially caught by MLB or not, but there definitely seem to be certain people where there's a pattern of that behavior that happens, and teams are definitely aware of that, and some of them don't care, and they still sign players from there because, I mean, sometimes you might still think a player could be older, and you might still think, well, maybe he's older, but I still like this. Like, he still could be a good player. There have been players who've falsified their ages, who've gone on to be big leaguers, all stars, great big leaguers too. But yeah, in terms of getting, in trouble with MLB or in the legal system of the country, no, it's pretty uncommon, I think, for that to happen. And because there are really no repercussions, that's part of why issues like that tend to continue over time. Because if you're not being penalized for bad behavior, then we'll do it again.
Yeah. All right. Well, good question. Again, thank you for saying that in Mets perspective. If you guys have questions you want us to answer, you can send it to me and Ben on Twitter or Instagram. Both of our handles are in the show notes. You can also email us at futureprojection@baseballamerica.com if you want to send us a question or any feedback for the show or just want to say whatever. But Ben, I think that's it for us today. You have anything else you want to mention before we hop off?
No, I mentioned Bishop Letson earlier, but I'll have a story up soon for some other we've had some other guys whose stuff has jumped up early in the season this year, so that should be up at BA on the website, I think Thursday, but maybe Friday. We'll see how busy the site is this week, but good problem to have with a lot of good content on the site.
Yeah, we do. There's a lot. There's a good variety of content from all levels of baseball. I'll just plug the mock and the new updated rankings on the site if you want to really get in the weeds on the draft class. You can, and I'll also plug Jeff's piece. He looked at stuff plus for pitchers, like an analytical look at the top five pitchers in the class. So that's always really interesting to me, just getting a new angle on some of these players that we're really bearing down on. So if you're really into the data, Jeff has a cool piece on that. So that's all for me. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll be off next week because I'll be traveling. But until next time, for Ben, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.